You were listening to the Never Meet Your Heroes podcast, conversations with artists about their work and inspiration. I am your host, Anthony Moses Sanchez. Welcome to another episode of Never Meet Your Heroes podcast. And on today's episode, we have Trevor Healy. So we'll go ahead and we'll start by having you introduce yourself.
Say hey, hello. Moses, I'm Trevor Healy.
So we'll start with, you could tell us where you're from and how you got into writing. I guess I should do full disclosure, though. I've known you forever.
For 20 years, I think. Yeah.
And yeah. I met you in Glendora.
So at a Starbucks, yeah.
Yeah.
I would go in there. I was in this strange town that I was suddenly living in, and there was Moses slinging coffee. Yeah.
Yep. And I mean, you're part of the reason why I got into writing and poetry.
Oh, that's
good.
You're
the ultimate that person. So
good.
If we need to get into that later. But I don't know a lot about how you got from Glendora, where I met you.
Yeah.
Which is like, by the way, people that don't know, that it's like, what, 20 miles east of L.A.?
It's actually 28 miles.
28.
Yeah, because sometimes I'm able to bill my commute.
Okay.
So I know exactly how far it is. So I was born in San Francisco, and then I was raised in Seattle. My dad was transferred around. He worked for an insurance company, and so Seattle's kind of home in a way. And then we came to L.A. for a couple years, and then we moved back to San Francisco, which was kind of the goal because my family's been there since like 1850, so all the relatives are there, all that. So that's kind of home. Mm-hmm. And then I went to college at Berkeley and high school there and all that shit, and then I stayed until 97, and that was the first dot-com boom thing. So it was getting very expensive. I was also burning out on San Francisco, so I decided to go to L.A., and I had a friend who said, oh, you can come live in my house in Glendora, you know, for like really cheap rent. And I thought, oh, I'll do that for start. So it's kind of a good landing strip. And then sometimes I stay there in between my trips abroad and stuff. So, and that's how I met you. I ended up in that little town, which is just, you know, kind of a random place. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So your time in San Francisco, though, that was like your first.
So that's when I really started writing and stuff like that in terms of, you know, I got out of school, I wanted to write, and I'd been sort of dabbling in it. But in San Francisco, there was a big spoken word scene. So that was great because, you know, I was coming out and going and reading my poetry, and it was a lot of fun. It was really an expansive period in my life. And in the 80s and 90s in San Francisco, it was really awesome. Every night there was several readings, so you could just go around. So got to know a bunch of people. It was very supportive, and it made me write because it'd be like, oh, another reading tomorrow, got to have something, right? Mm. So
right.
That was really, really great. But I always wanted to write fiction, and that wasn't really a venue for fiction. That was a venue for poetry, you know, or songs or short stuff. So I always wrote kind of narrative poetry, and I liked doing it. And in some ways, I was too impatient to write prose in those days. My 20s or whatever. So it was a good sort of foundation for later writing novels and such. So it's really good. Yeah.
So the scene there, was that still left over from that whole 60s?
Yeah, there was kind of a beatnik thing to it. You know, I think a lot of writers were in the scene were very connected to that kind of beat thing, you know, because what was it, the Black Cat in North Beach that, you know, Ginsberg and Kerouac made famous. And it was very much a place that was, I think those were the first, you know, readings like that. And so that sort of did start a tradition in San Francisco that persisted. You know, I mean, it moved around, but it always – and the poetry was a little bit like that. You know, it was very free form and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it could be pretty raucous, people drinking. A lot of nightclubs would have readings. It wasn't just coffee shops, you know. So it was definitely not like what we often think of as poetry and academia and stuff,
right,
where it's very staid and all that. These were kind of wild situations. And it kind of eventually, you know, kind of morphed into the slam type thing, which I think is very different. And I didn't particularly like that because of the competition. And it became a little bit more music-like, which, you know, is good in certain ways, but it wasn't exactly what I was going for. So it did change it a bit. And it made it a little bit more it made it sort of big. It created a bigger audience, but it also created a different feel to the readings.
Right. Definitely hip hop influences.
Yeah, definitely that. Yeah.
It's definitely driving poetry if you're paying attention to the hip, like Kendrick Lamar right now, his newest album, if you haven't heard it, probably it's just stuck, like this is chock full of poetry.
Yeah.
But it's like mixed with all the other stuff going on.
Yeah. And the good thing about it all is poetry really is music. And so the kind of merging the two is important, and it happens all the time. And You know, so that's been going on, and that's important, or that's just the reality of, mm-hmm. of what poetry is, and it's the way it sort of gets into the mainstream culture usually too.
Right. Do you want to, at this point, reminisce about that time? Do you feel nostalgic about that poetry scene?
You know, in some ways, I wouldn't say I'm a super nostalgic person, but I really liked it. And I liked it because it was real bohemian and low-key, and nobody knew what was going on. It was just this kind of small group of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it had a real purity to it. People just showed up and read their stuff and really shared their lives. It was very intimate in a way. You got to know these people. And... and you felt you could be really serious and say anything and do anything because it wasn't a big scene where, like, you didn't have to worry about, oh, what are people going to think? It's like, oh, this group of people doesn't care about anything. We can say whatever we want. So it mm-hmm. kind of had a laboratory feel that way, like, just try anything. You know?
Right. And I'm right to say that it was a queer scene and kind of a punk rock.
Yeah, it was kind of more of a punk rock scene. There were a few of us queer people in it, but it wasn't very queer, oddly enough. And then there was a few things going on, like around the Castro, that were more queer oriented, but then they were too queer oriented, mm-hmm. and that became another problem. And then, you know, in some ways, it seemed like the the queer scene was a little bit less literary about it in terms of readings. You know, mm-hmm. I guess it was more of a social place to share or whatever. So the best readings were all like South of Market and the Mission and stuff like that. And there were a few of us. There were like three or four of us queer people in there. But because it was very punk rock, it was very accepting. You know, there was mm-hmm. never a sense of, you know, that you felt in any ways not welcome. It was always very welcoming. Yeah.
I mean, I'm right to say that maybe there was no affect. You know,
yeah, it was weird because there were a lot of serious gay writers in the city, but it seemed like a lot of them were writing fiction. And so the poetry scene was weird that way because the gay poets that I knew of didn't want to go to those things. They were into the more academic poetry or whatever. So it's a little bit weird that way because it did feel outside of the queer scene.
Mm-hmm.
But that was also good because I've always liked to be a queer person among non-queer people. I've always found that kind of interesting.
Right.
And in a totally all queer scene, I think it gets kind of boring, actually.
Okay. I mean, like, I feel like the way that you introduced me, little suburban gay boy, to queer uh-huh. was you would just show up wearing like a woman's or a girl's shirt. Mm-hmm. Like that was like unknown.
My little pearl necklace I like to wear. Yeah.
So like that wasn't even – that didn't permeate yet because, you know, at that time we didn't have the internet.
Yeah, and that was
outside.
Very San Francisco, too. Like, mm-hmm. coming to L.A. was weird because L.A. is a little bit more normal in terms of, like, you can be weird, but San Francisco, you can kind of be weird anywhere. And people are walking around pretty fabulous, and everybody sort of was delighted by it, at mm-hmm. least in the 80s. Yeah, I don't know what it's like so much now, but I came to L.A., and it was more people go, what the fuck, dude? Are you a chick? Or, you know, they were very not comfortable with gender variance and that stuff,
uh-huh.
which was disappointing, and I think... I became somewhat more normal in my dress here because it just – people weren't delighted by weirdness. They were more like freaked out by it. And it's like, mm-hmm. I don't want to freak people out. I mean, that's one thing to do, but it's like I really – you know, I want to delight people. I want to like entertain them. And so if they don't get the pearl necklace, then maybe I don't need to wear it. And plus it did look – all that stuff looked cuter on me when I was young. You know, as I got older too, it's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't – it doesn't – it's sort of – I don't know what – it's not really ageism, but it's like something about as you get older – it's things look different on you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you know? So it's just like, oh, that stuff doesn't look as good as it did when I was really young. So.
I mean, I've definitely grown out of certain things where I'm like, yeah. I'm not really moving on.
Yeah.
It was something I needed to wear at 22, but,
you know. So, yeah, you move into different, you know, it's like you get bored of shit, you know? So
right. We all can't live like Madonna and just eternally be whatever.
Yeah, we can't just be fabulous. Boulevardier forever, yeah.
So let's move into, you know, what inspired you? It sounds like the scene, the San Francisco scene inspired you to write, like just having to show up and do everything. So maybe it was more you coming down here to L.A. and wanting to write fiction.
Well, and the weird thing was, as much as I was inspired by the scene up there and I felt it was supportive, it also could be oppressive because there were certain things going on in the scene. You felt like, oh, they don't get this, but they get this. And you started writing to that audience.
True.
So when I came to L.A. and I felt more disconnected and isolated,
mm-hmm.
at first I wasn't sure what to do, but in the end I found that really beneficial because I was at a place where I wanted to start writing fiction and writing a novel, and I really just needed to retreat. Mm-hmm. And I didn't need a scene, and I didn't need to bounce it off people. I felt like I'd kind of gotten an idea of all that from San Francisco. So I got here, and I really was ready to just do it. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, L.A. was really good for me. Or it was, not in some ways, it was good for me because I felt like this was a place I could actually do the work. San Francisco was a hard place to actually do the stuff because you were constantly being drawn out. It's a very social city. People are on the street. It's hard to isolate yourself in San Francisco, whereas LA, it's very easy to isolate yourself, you know, for better or worse. You know, but for me, it was really better. It was a good thing. It gave me the sort of privacy, time, and solitude to really write. So,
but it sounds like it worked for you because you were ready to artistically just kind of.
Yeah, it was the right sort of place in my life that, that I got here to. I needed that at that time, so it was fortuitous.
Yeah, I mean, definitely when you change a city, you start over. Yeah. As far as your
and yet you're still
network.
Writing about the last. You know, it's like you digest the last place you were. So I always feel like. After 10 years, I start writing about L.A. I needed 10 years to, like, write out my San Francisco-ness, which is weird, you know, because I feel like you're sort of carrying around your life, and a lot of it is still being expressed.
Right. You do kind of need that distance sometimes emotionally.
And it's sort of like your creativity transitions in a different way than your body or mind or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's on its own schedule and its own... It moves in its own way, in its own sweet time.
So what do you feel influences you or continues to influence or inspire you with your writing then?
What influences me? I mean...
You have different novels that you've written. So when you came here to L.A., you were saying about your, you know, even just now, you're kind of processing San Francisco.
So I was still writing. I mean, I came out in San Francisco, so I wrote a novel that was really a family novel, but it included a character who was coming out, so I kind of processed a lot of that. And, you know, I kind of thought, I think I write novels about sort of the big sort of sacramental things that happen to you in your life. You know, when I say sacraments, I'm kind of harking back to my Catholic upbringing, but the idea of, you know, baptism, marriage, death, all that. And for queer people, it's like coming out is kind of one of those, how that happens and what's the story around that. And then the AIDS epidemic for me and certainly people of my generation, that was a big deal. And so I wrote a novel about that, A Horse Named Sorrow, that was about two guys. And then I wrote Fawn, which was a little bit weirder. That is about L.A. Mm-hmm. And I think... Yeah, that's less about like that sacramental type idea, but it was more sort of about, I think, you know, in some ways it's like maybe if you think of who you really are, like I think I'm a fawn or whatever, like I was getting in touch with myself or something, but also getting in touch with that, the kind of like the weirdness of being a person who's really many different things. You can be queer and you can be of a particular race or ethnicity or you're a certain place, but you're also yourself and sort of feeling like I'm just sort of a weird person. So, but making peace with that. So I think in some ways writing Fawn was about, kind of getting to know and accept my own individuality, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Cause you have a Sweet Son of Pan.
Yeah, which was
so
it's
an image or it's an idea that you
that's
come back
kind
to
of
a few times.
Yeah, and very much the idea of a fawn in the Roman sense, not the Greek sense. You know, it comes from a satyr in the Greek sense, which is a much more, you know, satyrs are much more kind of violent and groupy. They kind of hang out in groups, whereas the fawn in the Roman tradition became much more of a like little creature wandering around by himself in the forest. It's a little sweeter and more pastoral, I guess.
Okay.
So I like that one better.
And is it similar to the idea of Pan? I mean, you said Sweet Son of Pan.
Yeah, I mean, Pan is the earth spirit, as you know, the sort of nature spirit of the Greeks, everything earthy, so sexual and, you know, really kind of, you know, I mean, he's like half goat, right?
Right, the half goat, half man.
So, I mean, he's the god, right? And then the satyrs are kind of they're different than Pan, but they're considered sort of like, you know, related to him or children of Pan or whatever, emissaries of Pan. And then, you know, a fawn is really the same thing, but it's been sort of filtered through the next culture, you know, that,
right.
that inherited the Greek tradition and then did its own thing with it, right?
Yeah, I mean, we could get into archetypes just on that alone.
Yeah,
how it's kind of funnels through.
I feel like the fawn becomes a more sensuous creature than the satyr or Pan, who was a little more brusque and... a little more aggressive and sexual, I guess, in a baser way than a fawn, you know?
Yeah, the satyr was somebody that, like, you had to avoid in the wilderness, right?
Yeah, they could be very scary. And, you know, the whole idea of panic, you know, the word panic comes from, you know, meeting Pan and, you know, just basically losing it, right? So there's a lot of, I mean, I'm not an expert on this stuff by any means, but as I've experienced it and read about it and done my own research, I felt like, oh, that's kind of the distinction. You know, there's a distinction there.
Well, what probably is important to touch on, though, is how the idea of Pan relates to your work. I mean, it's influenced you, or it's imagery that comes up a lot.
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, and it's, you know, I was very into the radical fairies for a long time, and, you know, still am somewhat, but not as intensely. And, you know, it's that kind of... I feel like there's a kind of earth sexuality. There's a way of being earthy about your sexuality that is a little bit more natural and it's sort of accepting who you are versus like some version that West Hollywood or the cast or whatever is piping in, or gay culture, which tells us so often what we're supposed to be like, what we're supposed to look like. And I kind of thought like, I just wanted to reject all that because it just felt more like the culture at large of, you know, telling people what they're supposed to be like and what's normal, you know, which is really oppressive. So
how would you describe the radical fairies? It started with Harry Hay, right? After the
Mattachine. Yeah, it started here in LA. I mean, Harry Hay, there were several people who were involved in it. Actually, it was like a group of people. And, you know, he's kind of well known as somebody who was a progenitor of it. But there was also Don Kilhefner and Mitch Walker. Those three guys, I think, together were kind of the main force. And they had the first fairy gathering in, I think it was in Arizona or New Mexico in like 1979, before my time. And I knew some of the people who'd been there, you know, like Mark Thompson, who lived here in LA and was a good friend of mine and a mentor of mine, passed away about a year ago. And then there are fairy sanctuaries all over the country now. But, you know, fairies are sort of these fabulous sort of gender loose, you know, it's very pagan, but it's also very, very much about like community in that sense of be yourself, have a fun, fabulous time. Don't be restricted by anything.
Right.
And not just the straight culture you live in, but also the gay culture, because Harry Hay responded a lot to what he saw the gay culture as becoming. And he felt like it's mimicking the straight culture a lot and a lot of things about, you know, whether it was gender roles, you're gay or you're straight or you're, you know, all the butch shit and femme shit, whatever. It's just like, you know, just be yourself. As we're seeing now, you know, whatever it is after Stonewall, what is it, you know, whatever, 50 years later, this gender stuff is starting to be unpacked and expressed. And that's really great because that that feels like the place where there's still a lot of freedom. Whereas a lot of gay culture sometimes feels like it's kind of become institutionalized as a certain thing, and it doesn't feel very free. So the fairies continue to exist, I think, because they are sort of a free place.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I don't know. I always feel like gay culture is always being born with any gay guy that comes out. I mean, with the internet now, people are able to connect to it much faster.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, not that you would know, maybe I should meet someone from Radical Fairies, but if they still have a lot of people connecting to it in that way. I know it did show up in the HBO show Looking. I think it was the beginning of second season where it's kind of like they went out to the forest and it's like glitter beard or flowers and you're like,
yeah, you know, sometimes
psychedelic drugs, which isn't always what it is.
But it includes all that. And it's very much, you know, you can kind of make it whatever you want, which is its power, you know? And I think one of the things I liked as like a young gay guy when I first went to the gatherings in Oregon was there wasn't that sense either like you were always being cruised and that you were always you walk into a bar and you always kind of know, okay, who am I in this situation? I'm the young guy, I'm the old guy, I'm the this guy, the that guy. And you kind of know your sexual currency, and it's kind of annoying because in a lot of gay community or reality, you often are sort of that's the message you're getting. Where do right. I fit in this hierarchy or whatever it is? And mm-hmm. the fairies, it was just, it was very friendly. And I never met more people. I had never met so many people outside my age. I used to feel scared of older guys, like, oh, they're cruising me because I'm 25 or whatever. And when I was at a fairy gathering, I realized, oh, no, these are all wonderful people. And they're coming at me as people instead right. of as guys looking for something. So it was really – and that's what Harry Hay talked about too, was a place where it doesn't deny sex, right? It's like, well, sex is available, right? And, right. and it may happen, but it isn't like the first thing. It isn't mm-hmm. this sort of blunt, okay, this first and everything else follows. So it was – really a nice way to connect to people. So it's really important for me in my development as a young guy who, you know, let's face it, I mean, coming out and being queer, you're all fucked up and you have lots of stuff right. to deal with, and it's really difficult. And no matter what normal face you put on it, mm-hmm. there's a lot of stuff you have to work out. And I just felt like it gave me an awesome space. I just thought it was a great space to work things out in. And
right.
and also there was the Billy Club. That was another group like the Fairies.
Okay, never heard of them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more in the Bay Area, of course. The Billy Club was sort of – they were like rural gay men, because there's kind of fissures within the fairies. Like
okay.
the Billies were sort of like, well, we're real country guys who really live in the country and
okay.
drive trucks and do whatever. And the fairies a lot of times were city people who come out to the gathering okay. and then they go back to San Francisco.
Like so early Burning Man, right?
Yeah, you know, some of the Burning Man stuff, yeah, is similar, right? You know, yeah. it starts to break down into people have like, you know, who's the real one and who's the that and mm-hmm. that. And so – but I thought they all had something to offer, and they were all alternatives to mainstream gay culture. Right. And then there were fairly mainstream retreat groups like Gay Men's Spiritual Retreat, Discovery, which came out of the Pacific Center in Berkeley, and they would have these retreats, and they were a little bit less crazy maybe than the fairies. The fairies are kind of the ultimate freewheeling thing, but they mm-hmm. all had a lot to offer, and they all were responding to the same need. It's like – gay guys are not getting what they need in the gay culture that exists. They're mm-hmm. lonely, they're miserable, they're drinking, taking drugs, whatever, having bad relationships, you know, all right. that stuff. And these retreats were sort of places for people to really deal with reality and connect on a deeper level. So I loved that stuff. It was great.
Right.
I miss it because there's not as much down here.
There isn't. And in fact, yeah. I was going to mention, like, I noticed now with the apps and people, you yeah. know, they are – you're talking about, you know, radical fairies were about not being heteronormative yeah. – but now there is still exists, at least here in LA, the sexual yeah. currency here. Mm-hmm. And like even what you're saying about looking back and like I'm still trying to deal with my trauma of trying to come out in West Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
Like because you yeah. that gets imprinted in you
right.
way faster and way harder than right. now. And I definitely know there's way more gay men sitting at home alone.
Yeah.
Than if they could go out to a radical fairy or something like
right.
that.
Right. And there used to be fairy gatherings here. For some reason there haven't been. But uh-huh. there's this great guy I know, Barry Schoenfeld, who started this thing called CalCom Men, Cal Community of Men. Mm. And he has these gatherings now that he's set up, and he's kind of done it on his own. And it kind of grew out of the California Men's Gathering, which is right. which was a thing for straight and gay men and bisexual men, but it's kind of become more queer over the years because okay. I think a lot of times the straight guys get scared away or, uh-huh. you know, or it becomes too, you know, more gay guys are drawn to it, whatever, and it doesn't fulfill their needs or whatever. But so there is some stuff going on, and like Barry's really been kind of great to watch him kind of create this thing from scratch. He just wants to create community, you know,
right.
and so they do little, you know, do little things around. I've been to a few of them, not a lot, but, you know, it is going on, but it needs to happen more in LA. I think it's always been sort of, cause there's a lot of people here, you
there
know,
is a
and,
lot.
It's a need that is not kind of being, and you know, maybe you and I should do something about it.
Yeah,
right? You know,
I feel like even with this podcast, because I guess yeah. I'm aware that I spend most of my time as an introvert, uh-huh. not to make this uh-huh. whole thing about me, but
yeah. or about introversion,
but no, like I am happy sitting at home yeah. with headphones on and I can listen to music or conversations all day. And I am guilty of not mm-hmm. going out. There's too much traffic. I mean, problem in LA is the traffic
right
now.
Right.
So
it's a more difficult city to connect in. San Francisco mm-hmm. was easy. I could just walk down the street, you know?
Right. But this harder. Podcast, it's like as if somebody who's in their car, mm-hmm. it's as though they're in the room with us.
Right.
So it's somehow creating a small community,
yes.
not as important as actually creating
yeah,
an
but
event.
That's good too, because you do what you can. You know, you
right.
take the environment you're in and you make it work somehow, you know?
Yeah.
So
should I get into a little bit before, because we went a little off track, but not off
yeah.
track. Should we talk about, Catholicism and being gay? Because I know it comes up for you, and I was raised Catholic up until I was like 8, but but I feel like my parents have never stopped being Catholic.
Yeah,
even though they're born again Christian.
Yeah, right. Because it's a culture. I've always felt that Catholicism is more a culture, which is why I love Latin America, because I feel like I know the culture, the Catholic culture. You know, I don't know the other parts of the culture. I mean, there's all sorts of aspects of a culture, but the Catholic part of it makes real sense to me, and and I'm comfortable in it. Not so much because I'm a Catholic, which I'm not, and I don't believe the theology or anything, but because it's a way of being that I learned as a child, and it makes total sense to me, right?
Right.
And it's a certain kind of respect, a certain kind of reserve, maybe. There's a little bit of a there's a gentleness and acceptance. The better parts of Catholicism I've tried to preserve.
Right.
And a sense of aesthetic and beauty and a sense of the sacred and a sense of spaces where you go that are sacred spaces to do what you need to do in that way.
Right.
So I appreciate aspects of it, but there's the whole, you know, institution of the Vatican and such, which I don't have any respect for, and it's something else. But, you know, like Joseph Campbell always said, the guy who wrote The Power of Myth and was very into mythology, he always talked about the church around the people. Whatever church is in your neighborhood actually belongs to you. It belongs to the people. So the idea of sacred space, it belongs to the people who are around it. So I go in Catholic churches all the time. Because it's like, that's my space. It's like, I don't go to mass. I don't deal with any of the stuff they want to throw at me. But it's like, it's my space to use as I see fit. It is not theirs. They own it and all that kind of bullshit. But that's not real. The real thing is, these are little caves, whatever, for those who are around it. So I kind of use it in that way.
Yeah, I do have a good example of when you, a couple of years ago, when we did the gay LA walk or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And you kind of disappeared into that one. What is it, on Hancock, that one church? Everyone's like, where'd Trevor go? I was like, there's a Catholic church over there. He has to go in and look at it.
Yeah, they're like, I like them as spaces. Yeah.
When I was in Spain, though, the one guy that I met there has the whole city, at least in Madrid, they have the same similar, like, they're like, oh, we just love going in them. Like, it's not about that we think God's there or that we believe in God or we love how beautiful they are.
Yeah, whatever your relationship to the sacred, you can be a Buddhist, you can be a pagan. I mean, I'm thankful because I feel like I'm a Marian heretic. I was raised, I actually believed that Mary was God because I wanted her to be God, because I liked the woman with the candles who looked like she could help. Whereas like the guy on the cross, why would I ask him for anything? He's like hanging on a cross. He kind of has enough trouble.
Yeah.
And then God the Father
eat some bread, actually.
Yeah. And then God the Father was mean, and I go, interested. So to me, it was like, oh, this is about Mary. And so that really was how I experienced Catholicism. And so I kind of grew up pagan.
Okay.
In that way, and then all the saints, you could sort of pick the ones you liked, and it was a pantheon, right? And I did a book called Queer and Catholic, which was an anthology of how, because I was curious, how did people deal with being Catholic? And for some people, it was more like my experience, where even though I had to go to church every Sunday and I had to go to CCD, which is the class they make you go to, if you're a Catholic and you're not in Catholic schools, you have to go to this like after school program in Catholicism, indoctrination. So, you know, with all that stuff, it was like, it wasn't a negative experience so much. I mean, certainly I got the messages that you're a homo and you're going to hell and all that stuff, and that was traumatic, you know? But at the same time, I felt, I don't think Mary feels that way. And there was a sense that a lot of Catholics were kind of like, well, they say that, but don't worry about it. It was a lot gentler and, you know, you could even call it corrupt, because a lot of people weren't really going by the rules. You know, Catholicism is often that way, like, well, you know, and that can be really bad, as we've seen with like priests being abusive and such, right? Because they're just letting, you know, they're kind of working around situations and then, you know, excusing themselves for us or stuff. And the church does it all the time. It was beneficial to someone like me because I thought, I don't think they're really going to throw the book at me on this. Like, whereas the people I knew who were Protestant, especially fundamentalists, like those people were being like, you're going to die and burn and, you know, horrible, traumatic. Right. Those people, those churches should all be like outlawed and
definitely but tax exempt. I feel probably the one thing that we can talk about.
And they're not, politics. I mean, they're not churches really. If you're abusing children, you're not a church. You're a criminal organization, and then you don't have to pay taxes, whatever. So, you know, I don't want to judge all churches. They're all different. But anyway, so I felt fortunate that it wasn't too hard. You know, it wasn't too hard on me. And I feel now that it's like, oh, you know, it was supportive in certain ways. But, you know, the culture at large is homophobic. So it's like, well, right. The church in some ways reflects the people and the culture. And yes, it feeds into it as well. But it's coming from a bunch of angles, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's coming from the baseball diamond. It's coming from the church. Coming from all over the place, you know?
Right.
So.
So you mentioned earlier you had some mentors that you – you know, had been around that kind of helped you through different moments. And how would you kind of describe, like, some mentors just help you kind of like your spiritual guide or your writing or just somebody who kind of steps in. Like even, I mean, obviously I mentioned you're a mentor of mine. Mm-hmm. They kind of just suddenly there's somebody that's like, hey, you should do that.
Yeah, I mean, if you kind of follow what you're interested in, you end up around these people.
Exactly.
And they say, oh, that guy really knows something. And you know, I always sought out older people. I was always drawn to older gay guys because I didn't date them. I was attracted mm-hmm. to guys my own age, but I was like, I wanted to know they know something. Mm-hmm. They're like fathers, right?
And
like, my father doesn't know this stuff. So in some sense, when you're a gay boy, you know, it's like you need a father figure and your father knows nothing about the world you live in. So I felt it was really natural that I need to go seek fathers in the gay world who can tell me, how is this done? Like, how does mm-hmm. somebody be a writer? How does somebody have a relationship? How does somebody deal with the fact that, yeah, you know, we don't get married. I mean, people get married now, but when I was coming out, it's like that wasn't part of it. And in the way, you know, gay sexuality expresses itself in very different ways than the heteronormative model, you know?
Right.
So it's like my father ceased to exist in a way, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just natural to look for mentors, you know? So then I ended up having lots of them, you know? And like I said, Mark Thompson was one and mm-hmm. Felice Pacano was really helpful as a writer because I met him when I came here to LA and I was just kind of mm-hmm. like, how do you do this? How do you get published? How do you do the whole thing? And he knew it really well because mm-hmm. he'd been doing it for all these years and he was one of these kind of pioneering people and he was very helpful and he still is. He's really helpful to young writers and I felt lucky that, oh, I met this guy because I'd met all sorts of writers. I'd go to readings and they weren't always that friendly.
Right.
Or they didn't even want to talk to you. And some of them are very introverted and all that. So, you know, it's not a judgment on anybody, but mm-hmm. it was like, meaning Felice was like, he's like, hey, why don't you come over to my house and we'll talk about it? You know, it's like, wow, this is great. You know, mm-hmm. so finding people who want to share and want to mentor also is important because not everybody wants to do it. And you can't require someone to do it, right?
Right. Well, sometimes I feel like mentoring doesn't mean like you're just going to call them. It's not like your parent.
Right,
like,
right.
Calling every week. How are you doing?
Right.
Are you writing? Like,
although, you know, it can. I mean, for some people, they need. I've had a few people that I've mentored where it's like they just need somebody to keep them on track. And so I'd be, hey, what's going on? Oh, you're doing that again. Well, didn't you decide that was something you didn't want to be? Yeah, well, then maybe, you know, you think about it. I mean, you know, you can kind of cue people. Uh-huh. And if that's what they want, you know, you kind of sense what does this person want me around for? And you try mm-hmm. to provide that, right?
I mean, some of this has been subject of some of the people that you've written about as well, right? Mm-hmm. I remember some of the stories about some of the guys you've taken in and try to help out and kind of careens one way or the other.
Not so much. I mean, you know, I think when I was younger, maybe I had more of a sense of, oh, I can really help this person. And, you know, mm-hmm. I'm old enough now to realize, you know, it basically people help themselves and you can really only ask somebody, what is it you would like from me or what is it I can do for you? And, mm-hmm. and they can ask you, but you really can't invade their life and say, I'm going to do this and that. That's just folly, you know, but you don't know that when you're young. When you're young, you're like, oh, this guy's brilliant. And if I can just get him off junk, he'll really be great and make films. It's like, yeah, but him getting off junk is his thing. And, you know, that's really not in your ability to affect that much other than, you know, be a friend in whatever way they need you to be, you know.
Or I'd share my problem in my 20s was just not realizing that when he disappeared for several days that he was on drugs. Mm-hmm. I'd just be like, oh, he's not answering his phone.
Yeah.
I hope he shows up tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, oh.
Who knows? Yeah. And I mean, you know, you don't always know where people are and what they're doing and it's not necessarily your business, you know. But you get wiser and you start to see the signs and you have a sense of what people are doing when you're not with them. Oh, this one's working all the time. Okay, well, that's okay.
How do you get between the line of you're going to write about somebody in real life and fictionalize them? You know, because like even when we look back at the Beats, you kind of know who's who, but you still are supposed to fictionalize them.
Right.
So, but the people that you're writing about are still alive in some regards, probably. So how do you...
Yeah, because you think something like Jack Kerouac, it's like what in Dharma Bums, I think it's Alva Goldberg is guess who, you know?
Yeah.
I think when you're starting out, it's harder to separate reality from fiction a little bit. Like you tend to write in a more memoirish way and you write a character who's like, oh, that's based on that guy. I mean, some people do that. That's the way they like to write or whatever. For me, I felt like I write more composite characters. So I'll take, okay, I like that aspect of that person. I don't want to just write about that person, but there's something about them that's got me started to describe this character. But then I want to change them a bit and maybe use three or four people to create one person. And I think with time, writing and creating characters, it becomes easier to do that and to just make up people completely. But, you know, certain aspects of their character might be informed by, you know, okay, this guy grew up in Glendora or whatever, so I can take Moses' experience, whatever, and throw it into my character, you know, like that. So I don't... And I, you know, I was always self-conscious about it. I don't want to write about somebody who's going to go, I know that's me. You know, like I always felt like I don't want somebody coming around saying that or whatever. And I also don't want to do that to somebody. Like I don't want them to feel like, wow, you just completely exposed me. And maybe some people do feel that way. I mean, I know that my mother at one point felt exposed in my first book. I said, but it's not you, Mom, even though it was a lot like her. You know, I said, you know, she has a different name. It's not you. And she goes, you're right. And I go, therefore, it's not you, right? And she really bought that. She goes, you're right. That's not my name. It can't be me. Great. And she just let it go. So whatever, you know, some people are satisfied with very little that, you know, will convince them that this person is not them when, in fact, it's pretty close to them. But like I say, that was my first book.
Okay.
Now none of my characters would be identifiable.
Oh, okay.
As one particular person or a real person.
So you've just gotten better at it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also, you know, it starts to become fun to create people. I think when you get when you feel like you can get good at creating people, it starts to be fun. Like, oh, I want to create somebody here, and you know, I can make them just how I want them to be. Or,
but you do generally try to base it on real people. Or you fictionalize a real person, but you don't just make up somebody out of thin air. Like,
Because I mean, you need to know something. I mean, if somebody grew up in El Salvador, you know, you really should know what it's like to grow up there, and so you probably should know several people who grew up there or go there and spend time there. So, I mean, people will always inform your characters if they're going to be good, well-developed characters because, you know, they have to pass the reality test, right? I mean, you can't just make it up. And you know, I'm sure we've all seen characters where people just say, oh, this guy is, you know, whatever. He grew up in Virginia, and you can tell very quickly, like, this person's never been to Virginia, knows nothing about, you know, that's really obvious. So it's really important to, if you're going to put certain things into a character, you better know what you're talking about. And if you don't, you need to find out, you know. I mean, if you want to write a good character, right? I mean, some people don't care. But, you know, for me, it's like, I want it to be convincing. I want this person to be real, you know.
Yeah. Some people are just putting stuff out so they can get attention, so.
Yeah, or, I mean, they're doing whatever they're doing. You know, it's fine. Do whatever you want. Yeah, but, yeah, for me, it's like, I really want to, you know. So I end up learning something. I mean, creating a character can be really a great way to learn about something, you know, because you might just say, for some reason, I want this guy to be from Virginia. I have no interest in Virginia. And then you go to Virginia and you meet people and suddenly you're really interested in Virginia and it opens up a whole new world you didn't know about. So, you know, that's kind of gravy, or that's great. That creates a whole nother level of reality that you didn't have before that is now in your life, you know.
You've done a little bit of traveling to get like little, I would say, retreats for different writing things. So I guess that'd be, you know, you made Virginia as an example, but Do you feel like that's been important to you?
Yeah, but like living in Argentina and Chile and Mexico has been really great because it's like, okay, I've really gotten to know these cultures much better than I would have known them if I hadn't lived there. And I still feel I need to learn more. To, you know, I'm writing a story set in Argentina right now. And, you know, I lived there about a year and I feel that's not really enough. I need to go back there or something because it's like I'm creating these characters and I feel like, you know, I need to – maybe I need to live there 5 years. Like, I started asking myself, how long should you live somewhere before you start, you know, creating a story and characters and a whole thing there? Because you're kind of laying claim to it in a way, you know?
Right.
then you need to get it right. And you need to ask yourself, yeah, why are you doing this? And what are you trying to learn? And what are you trying to say? So a lot of times it drives you back to the places. And so I don't know whether I'm going back there. I mean, I know you've been to Argentina as well. So
yeah.
My husband's, how far away it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. JP's from there, right? Yeah.
Yeah. My only issue was the economy and the state of disruption from corrupt politics.
Right.
So that was a very odd place to be.
There was a sort of weird sense of like, nothing works here, therefore do whatever you can. And so it kind of created a very kind of lax kind of moral system in terms of survival. And, you know, I loved it there and I loved the people, but that was a concern. Like, you know, people would buy houses and apartments there. And that's kind of tricky because it's like, well, stuff happens where, you know, I knew one guy where they wouldn't let him have his title. And I mean, all sorts of awful things. It's just a lot of corruption that, you know, I wasn't dealing with anything like that. I was just living in an apartment and walking down the street. So it wasn't so bad. But to really get involved in Argentina is a little dicier, you know. But that's its history. And that's what I want to write about, too, because it's very interesting how it got to where it is. And there's a lot of hope for it to change. But it's in a pretty corrupt state. I mean, it's so bad that it's hard to change. You know, the institute, like the justice system there, is just really corrupt. And when you have an incorrupt or a corrupt justice system, it's like that's a very difficult thing for people because they can't really complain or get anything. They can't get any justice if they're cheated because there's no system to deliver that. Whereas we kind of take that for granted here, and it doesn't work 100% here either, but it works pretty good compared to a lot of places.
Well, I think people here still believe in the system, and because occasionally there is somebody who does fight so hard that it, you know, we're like, oh, okay, someone's, someone's really following up on that. But down there, I, you know, a lot of times I was not allowed to speak. I don't speak Spanish very well, but I think also it was the family that I was with because they lived through the dictatorship.
Yeah.
So they were very like fearful of us being out at night.
Yeah.
So that really influenced like the mentality of like, you know, you don't go here and don't talk to this person.
Yeah. And that was a real experience of state terror for people. I mean, they had a government that was fascist and that was hunting its own people. I mean, that was really – it's a really creepy, creepy thing that happened there.
Right.
I mean, their sense of the other was people on the left were other, you know.
Yeah.
And they were – they considered – leftist thinking to be a disease that could be spread through families. And I mean, really creepy, like kind of uber fascist.
Right.
That dictatorship was seriously evil, you know, and people lived through that. And and in Chile, similarly with Pinochet, who was not quite as insane as the Argentine version, but in some ways more traumatic because he lasted longer and he was actually smarter about how he did it, you know. But they've had a similar history through the, you know, the 70s through that, you know, and, you know, a lot of it was supported by Nixon and Kissinger and, you know, very, very American influenced.
Right.
It may not have happened without U.S. intervention. So that's disturbing, too. And as an American, you're aware that people are aware of that.
I barely found out about some of the CIA stuff. Oliver Stone documentary about the history of America.
Yeah, it's pretty disturbing. And, you know, in Latin America, you learn about it quickly if you look into it. It's like, you know, the U.S. has had an influence on the history of every single country in a pretty deep way and usually a pretty disturbing and evil way, really.
So did you want to go back, continue working on whatever novel you're working on there in Argentina?
Yeah, I mean, I get a lot of writing done in Latin America for whatever reason, so it's a good place for me to write, and you know, and I have friends there, so yeah, maybe, you know, if I can find a way to like I say, it's like Argentina, because of or like you were saying, the economy is so volatile, it's not always cheap. Sometimes it's cheap, sometimes it's expensive, whereas like Mexico you can rely on to be pretty cheap, and I can last a long time there and write, whereas I go to Argentina and sometimes it's like, you know, the
bread goes up,
and they falsely support their currency, so the exchange rate isn't really correct, and it's just harder to predict. You know,
well, just walking around with like wads of cash the whole time was kind of odd.
Yeah, and you can trade money on the streets and alleys and such, which is, you know, weird. And everybody wants U.S. cash, like for your rent. So I had to go to leather shops because all the tourists would buy leather because it's cheap there because of all the cattle and beef and stuff. So to get cash to pay my rent, there's no way to get cash. They won't let – because they have limits on giving out cash, at least during the Cristina years. You know, now it's different maybe. But So I couldn't get enough cash to pay my rent. And everybody would say, well, too bad, you have to get it or we're evicting you. And right. You're like, well, how am I going to get it? So it's like, go to the leather store. I'd go to the back door. I knew this guy, Wani. He's like, how much you need? You know, you know, it's like everything sort of like that. It feels like drug deals.
Everything's very mafioso feeling. Yeah. That's how they all live.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and it's very insecure because like somebody could have, you know, kind of just jumped us at the back door. I mean, we're exchanging money. It's not a bank. You know, it's a little, a little crazy. But I had no problem there. I was lucky, you know, and so.
I mean, the good thing about because you said you have friends, though, is once you have a network there, that's how you traverse. It's like the opposite of America,
right?
Where we talk about being isolated here in LA.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a set of people in Argentina, they can get you to the other set of people.
Right. You protect each other and you find your way because everything's connections and networks.
Right. Because otherwise you can't survive there.
Yeah.
There's just impossible. You can't be an island to yourself there. Exactly. Or maybe you can if you're rich enough. But I mean,
but I think you're right. It's a different social setup that way.
I mean, I know that's why my husband's family, wouldn't come here because they have such deep, like they don't have a lot of living family, but they have such deep connections to their friends that it would be devastating to lose that. And,
right.
And they would be a missing chain as well.
Yeah. And it's very far away.
Yeah.
It's really far away. Yeah. So it's like.
Supposedly was better.
Yeah. Yeah. No, things, I mean, you know, they've had democracy for 25 years and it's functioned, you know. I mean, there's still a lot of corruption, obviously, but it's like, you know, generals were running that country for most of its history and most of the 20th century. So the fact that they've had 25 plus years of democracy is really a great achievement. So. You know, let's hope that continues, right?
It takes a while for a country to recover from something like that, though. It's not an overnight thing.
Yeah.
Especially because the corruption kind of stays after the fact. So let's go into, do you have, you know, we've talked about your different novels. So far, do you have a piece of work that you've done so far that is like your favorite, that you're the most proud of?
I think Horse Named Sorrow, that novel, is what I'm most proud of.
Okay.
You know, it's a road trip on a bicycle, and which is something I did long ago. And it's about San Francisco in a lot of ways, even though it doesn't take place there. It's about that San Francisco I lived in and how it influenced these characters. And so and I was able to, you know, I love nature and I'm a backpacker and all this stuff. So on the trip across the country, it was great because I could get into all this natural beauty and talk about that. And it's kind of my American book in a way, like my relation to what America is, you know, which is like this very beautiful place, but I'm not into it like in that patriotic sense at all. It's, I think it's a place of like, I'm more focused on the grief of it. And the book was really about grief and how this is, you know, and every place is, I suppose, but that, this is really a nation of incredible grief. You know, you think of slavery and the Native American genocide. And it's like a really, it's a sad, dark thing. And it always plays itself off as very light and happy and good. And, and I, you know, I think what's going on now in our culture in some ways is very good because we're starting to look at all this stuff. But, but for a lot of people, it's too much, too fast and they're freaking out. And, you know, we all know what we're going through, but it's, you know, it's reality. It's like if you've had a traumatic childhood, at some point you have to look at it and come to terms with it before you can grow up, you know? So I think that's kind of what this country's doing. And so that book's kind of about that stuff because I think that's what the AIDS crisis, you know, kind of put me into was all the things that happen and that, you know, I mean, the way AIDS was just ignored by Reagan and and Bush, it was terrible. It was just like, wow, this is just another genocide. This is just no one cares. It's just it's actually what they want.
How do you feel like this is something I think for everyone that lived through the AIDS generation when there wasn't a cure? Uh-huh. Like, how do you can you look back enough and say like how much it's affected your sexuality?
Yeah, because you know it's interesting, especially with the PrEP thing. You know, it's come up, and you know when you. You came out into it. It came out in the 80s into the AIDS crisis. You were just you learned about safe sex and you were vigilant because, you know, if you didn't do it, people were seroconverting all the time. And so I just got used to that. It's fine with me. I never had a problem with condoms or anything. I know people get allergic to them or just they hate them. They just don't like the way it affects them. But for me, it's never been a problem. So the PrEP thing's been kind of weird because I have people my age who've gone on it and they're like, oh, it's great. You know, it's much freer and all stuff. But, you know, I also have this sense of, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on this and it's a complicated topic. And as I understand, the drug was really developed for like couples where one was positive and one was negative.
Right.
The idea was to use condoms and PrEP.
Yep.
And the way PrEP seems to have played out is people take PrEP and condoms are gone.
Yeah.
And so what I worry about is, even though it's considered safer than condoms, you know, all the other STDs can spread. And the idea of, you know, AIDS came out of nowhere and something else can come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So the thing that worries me about PrEP is it's really only focused on this one particular disease. And what if some other disease came along? You'd just all be at the whim of nature. And, you know, maybe that's being paranoid, but it's like, that is how it's affected me. It's like, well, this is what happened when I was a young person coming out. And so it's made me perhaps conservative about that. Like, I think it's important to be vigilant. And, you know, I'm a sex positive person and it's great. There's lots of sex available in a gay life and in an American life in a sense. But it's also like, it's like anything. It's like, it is a risky thing and you need to be aware of that. And so I sometimes worry that people think, oh, I don't need to worry, I'm on PrEP, you know?
Right.
It's like, well, you know, that's like saying, oh, I have insurance, I don't have to worry about my health, you know?
Yeah, it's
like,
I can just jump in front of this car because I have insurance.
Yeah, it's not, you know, I sometimes worry about Americans especially. They don't sometimes have a very good sense of reality, I think, because it's like they feel so safe because, you know, they don't live in a war zone. I mean, they take a lot for granted and we take our health for granted in the same way. And I just think it's important to be, you know, whatever. You hope for the best and expect the worst, I guess. And maybe that's my attitude. Maybe that's a little pessimistic. But
no.
From what I know of life, I think there's some pretty hard truths out there and you need to protect yourself and be smart.
Well, I mean, that might be the answer to, you know, you living through an era where that was an issue.
Yeah. And it may have affected me in a way that, like, okay, that affected this person's thinking and, you know, the way he sees things. Yeah. And, I suppose, you mean our experience does affect us, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
now at least subject comes up, at least it doesn't feel as though being HIV positive is like this death sentence. Like,
right.
At least that part, the stigma.
Yeah. And then I think sometimes people make this assumption too, like, well, you know, now it's treatable, so it's fine. It's like people suffer terribly from the disease still. It's not just because it's treatable does not mean it's okay, you know, to have it. It's a very difficult thing. Some people more difficult than others, but it's like it's still a very serious thing that you don't want to be casual about. Kind of have to be sober about the whole thing. Okay, you know, what works for which person? Because you also can't tell everybody to behave the same way because everybody is, for some people, PrEP is a great thing. It's like what they need. You know, for other people, like for me, it's like, I don't think it's the way to go, but it's like, that's me. We all have different personalities and different ways of dealing with this. And yeah, you can't repress people and tell them you got to follow this road because, you know, sexuality is about freedom. So you've got to always work with that. Like, what works for a person? You know?
Yeah, I've seen that.
And so we have more options now, and that's a good thing. There's more options than there used to be.
Yeah, but I've seen that debate from, like, that generation that lived through the 80s.
Like, yeah.
You're not being as dogmatic about it, but I do see, like, you know, how could you guys, you know, you don't know what it was like. And it's,
yeah. I mean, that stuff comes up. And, you know, I know guys my age who are on PrEP in these trial groups. And, you know, they're talking to me about it. And it's interesting. I find it really interesting. And, you know, they're kind of encouraging me. And I'm like, I think I'm okay with keeping it the way it is. But I'm not going to argue with you and say you're wrong and all that, you know. But I'm curious about, you know,
like,
your experience.
Join us.
And, yeah. I mean, you know, in some ways I admire them for their, like, oh, wow, you're willing to just change it up and try a completely new thing, you know, and maybe that's something I'll do eventually. Right now I'm feeling like, you know, it's working out. Things have worked out okay this way, so I'm going to stick with it for now. We'll see what happens.
It isn't broke, why fix it, right?
Yeah, kind of that thing, yeah.
As we get towards the end here, which artists, writers are you keeping an eye on these days? It could be anything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that whole idea of the golden age of TV, I think, is important. The idea of things like Transparent and Mad Men and The Wire, these great TV series that are like novels and they're well written. And I know some people who've written for Transparent, for instance. And, like, so watching those is really, I find that interesting because it's really great to see TV elevated
right.
to kind of a literary level or at least a novelistic level in a way that it never has been.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of keep track of that stuff. But, you know, in terms of books, I mean, I'm really kind of not into, like, oh, what's the latest book that was written or what's contemporary or whatever. I'm kind of very into other cultures, and, like, I'm reading a lot of Latin American stuff now. And, you know, whether it's 100 years old or 50 years old, a lot of times I like stuff that's a little older because I feel like I learn more about, you know, I'm always interested in history as well. And so it kind of gives me a little bit of both.
Okay.
And also newer things almost everywhere are starting to be similar because the world culture, the global culture is such an influence that, I mean, that's interesting in itself, but I sort of like the idea of stuff that's coming from a world that is really different than mine, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a little bit harder to find. So, you know, I mean, I have favorite authors like Tom Spanbauer. The last book he wrote was awesome. And every book he writes, I watch for, you know, because I think he's a really wonderful queer writer. And certainly, you know, I'm always watching what's coming out, you know, queer books are coming out and what sorts of stuff is, mm-hmm. is being noticed and being written. So, you know, I keep an eye on all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm really particular about what I like, too. Like, I recently was on a total Angela Carter bender. I just love her writing, you know.
Right.
And, of course, she has passed away, so I'm not waiting for her next book, although there's quite a few, so I'm still digging my way through. Or Bolaño, you know, Roberto Bolaño. I loved his stuff. I read everything, you know.
Right.
And it's like, and the thing is, it's almost like he's still alive because they keep translating new things they find that haven't been translated to English. And while I speak Spanish, my Spanish isn't good enough to really enjoy reading, so I prefer to read it in English. You know, I don't know. I kind of follow whatever comes along. Somebody will mention something. I'll just kind of come across it, like you were saying, you know, about like mentors. It's like a lot of times books I'll find that way. It's like somebody will say something about something and then they'll be, oh, did anybody ever write about that? Mm-hmm. I mean, for instance, I was reading this book, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. I thought that was really interesting. And then he refers to these other people he read. And it's like some weird English guy who went to Ceylon, or which was Ceylon, is now Sri Lanka.
Okay.
You know, back in 1930, before anybody was doing that kind of stuff, and lived there and was really into like digging his way through the Pali Canon and learning all this stuff. And, you know, so suddenly I'm reading his book, you know, and luckily the Los Angeles Public Library is awesome. That's like the best thing about being in LA for me.
It is
a repository of everything. And it's really awesome because I can find any book there. And I'm kind of drawn to more and more obscure things, I think, as I go. So it's nice to have that nearby.
They also keep updating, like, even their digital library. So I like that, you know, you can have e-books and real books and audiobooks.
And now you can watch movies. They stream movies now.
Yeah, that's true.
They have an incredible library of movies, you know, and it's free. I mean, they limit you to like 5 or 10 a month or something, but it's an awesome thing.
Suddenly we're advertising for
I know.
Which is fine, because I don't think they'd pay anybody to advertise. But yeah, like just even like, you know, be part of the conversation there. Like, this is like Halloween week that we're recording this. So all month I've been watching the Universal films, and I got into James Whale, who was the gay director in the 30s. And I knew that movie Gods and Monsters that Ian McKellen was in. So I watched that, but I didn't know James Whale's films.
So now
I'm obsessed and I'm on Netflix and I'm like down. I'm like watching everything I can watch by him. I relate to that. Like, you just kind of, you don't know what you're going to find.
Yeah.
And then when you do, you
just get... One thing leads to another and you go totally hog wild into it. Yeah. And it's all there and accessible. That's great.
But anyone that loves like a queer, campy Bride of Frankenstein is brilliant. I was like, oh my God, this thing is a gay man's dream.
Okay. I'm going to write this down. I'm going to have to see it.
You have to check it out. It's like this hidden, like... People know about it. People have seen it, obviously. The Bride is iconic.
Yes,
but
right. I used to have, what was that card game? It had all the monsters. I don't know, but she was in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I know she exists.
Well, that kind of wraps us up here then.
Okay.
Thank you for being on this podcast. Where can everybody find you online, your website?
It's just my name, trevorhealy.com. So if you can spell my name, you can find me.
All right. Yeah. And if anybody listening has any questions, you can post in the comments, email us.
So you put this on Facebook, So there can be a conversation. Great. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, obviously anything that you post and we can come back and revisit some subjects or you can redact something.
Yeah. I didn't really say that. I asked him to edit it.
Fake news. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for being with me, Trevor. Okay.
Thank you, Moses.
Thanks for listening to Never Meet Your Heroes podcast. Find us at nevermeetyourheroespodcast.com, where you can post comments, ask questions, and interact with artists and listeners. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. And if you're on YouTube, don't forget to comment, like, and subscribe.